The boy jumped when Dustfinger turned to him. Farid had put aside the dish with the money in it and was just about to place a burning matchstick in his mouth. He quickly pinched it out with his fingers. Dustfinger suppressed a smile.
"He's dead set on learning to play with fire. I've shown him how to make little practice torches. But he's in too much of a hurry. He has blisters on his lips all the time."
Meggy looked sideways at Farid. He seemed to be ignoring them as he packed Dustfinger's things back in the bag, but she felt sure he was listening to every word they said. She met his eyes twice, those dark eyes, and the second time he turned away so abruptly that he almost dropped one of Dustfinger's bottles.
"Hey, be careful with that, will you?"
snapped Dustfinger impatiently. "I hope there's no other reason why you're still here," asked Mo as Dustfinger turned back to him.
"What do you mean?"
Dustfinger avoided his gaze.
"Oh, that. You think I might go back for the book? You overestimate me. I'm a coward."
"Nonsense." Mo sounded irritated. "Eleanor will be home tomorrow," he said.
"Nice for her." Dustfinger looked impassively at Mo's face. "So why aren't you with her?"
Mo looked at the buildings around them and shook his head. "There's someone I have to visit first."
"Here? Who is it?"
Dustfinger put on a short-sleeved shirt, a bright garment with a pattern of large flowers. It didn't suit his scarred face.
"There's someone who might still have a copy."
Dustfinger's face remained unmoved, but his fingers gave him away. They were suddenly having difficulty getting the buttons of his shirt through the buttonholes.
"That's impossible," he said hoarsely. "Capricorn would never have overlooked one."
Mo shrugged. "Maybe not, but I'm going to try all the same. The man I'm talking about doesn't sell books, either new or second-hand. Capricorn probably doesn't even know he exists." Dustfinger looked around. Someone was closing the shutters in one of the surrounding houses, and on the other side of the square, a few children were playing around among the chairs of a restaurant until a waiter shooed them away. There was a smell of warm food and the liquid spirits Dustfinger used in his fiery games, but no black-clad men could be seen anywhere, except for the bored-looking waiter who was straightening the chairs.
"So, who is this mysterious stranger?"
Dustfinger lowered his voice to little more than a whisper. "The man who wrote Inkheart. He lives not far from here." Farid came over to them, holding the silver dish with the money in it.
"Gwyn hasn't come back," he told Dustfinger, "and we don't have anything to tempt him. Should I buy a couple of eggs?"
"No, he can look after himself."
Dustfinger ran a finger over one of his scars.
"Put the money we've taken into the leather bag. You know, the one in my backpack," he told Farid. His voice sounded impatient.
Meggy would have given Mo a hurt look if he had spoken to her like that, but Farid didn't seem to mind. He just hurried off purposefully.
"I really thought it was all over. No way to get back ever again."
Dustfinger broke off and looked up at the sky. A plane crossed the horizon, coloured lights blinking. Farid looked up at it too. He had put the money away and was standing expectantly beside the backpack. Something furry scuttled across the square, dug its claws into his pants legs, and clambered up to his shoulder. With a smile, Farid dug his hand into his pocket and offered Gwyn a piece of bread.
"Suppose there really is still a copy?"
Dustfinger pushed his long hair back from his forehead.
"Will you give me another chance? Will you try to read me back into it just once?"
There was such longing in his voice that it went to Meggy's heart. But Mo's face was not forthcoming.
"You can't go back, not into that book," he said. "I know you don't want to hear me say so, but it's the truth, and you'd better resign yourself to it. Perhaps I can help you some other way. I've got an idea, rather crazy, but still..."
He said no more, just shook his head and kicked an empty matchbox that was lying on the paving stones. Meggy looked at Mo in surprise. What kind of idea? Did he really have one,
or was he just trying to comfort Dustfinger? If so, it hadn't worked.
Dustfinger was looking at him with all his old hostility. "I'm coming," he said. His fingers had left a little soot on his face where he stroked his scar. "I'm coming when you go to visit this man. Then we'll see."
There was loud laughter behind them. Dustfinger looked around. Gwyn was trying to climb onto Farid's head, and the boy was laughing as if there was nothing better than to have a marten's sharp claws digging into his scalp.
"Well, he's not homesick anyway," muttered Dustfinger. "I asked him. Not homesick in the least. All this," he added, waving a hand at his surroundings, "all this appeals to him, even the noisy, stinking cars. He's glad to be here. You've obviously done him a favour."
The look he gave her father as he said those words was so reproachful that Meggie instinctively reached for Mo's hand. Gwyn had jumped down from Farid's shoulder and was sniffing curiously at the road surface. One of the children, who had been romping among the tables, bent down and looked incredulously at the little horns. But before the child could put a hand out to touch, Farid quickly intervened, picked Gwyn up, and put the marten back on his shoulders.
"So where does he live, this—"
Dustfinger did not finish his sentence.
"About an hour's drive from here."
Dustfinger said nothing. The lights of another plane were blinking up in the sky.
"Sometimes, when I went to the spring to wash early in the morning," he murmured, "there'd be tiny fairies flitting around above the water, not much bigger than the butterflies you have here, and blue as violet petals. They liked to fly into my hair. Sometimes they spat in my face. They weren't very friendly, but they shone like glowworms by night. I sometimes caught one and put it in a jar. If I let it out at night before going to sleep, I had wonderful dreams."
"Capricorn said there were trolls and giants, too," said Meggie quietly. Dustfinger gave her a thoughtful look.
"Yes, there were," he said. "But Capricorn wasn't particularly fond of them. He'd have liked to do away with them all. He had them hunted. He hunted anything that could run."
"It must be a dangerous world." Meggie was trying to imagine it all. The giants, the trolls, and the fairies. Mo had once given her a book about fairies. Dustfinger shrugged.
"Yes, it's dangerous, so what? This world's dangerous too, isn't it?"
Abruptly he turned his back on Meggie, picked up his backpack, threw it over his shoulder, then waved to the boy. Farid picked up the bag with the balls and torches and followed him eagerly. Dustfinger went over to Mo once more.
"Don't you dare tell that man about me," he said. "I don't want to see him. I'll wait in the car. I only want to know if he still has a copy of the book. Understand?"
Mo shrugged his shoulders. "As you like." Dustfinger inspected his reddened fingers and felt the taut skin.
"He might tell me how my story ends," he murmured.
Meggie looked at him in astonishment. "You mean you don't know?"
Dustfinger smiled.
Meggie still didn't particularly like his smile. It seemed to appear only to hide something else.
"What's so unusual about that, princess?" he asked quietly. "Do you know how your story ends?"
Meggie had no answer to that. Dustfinger winked at her and turned.
"I'll be at the hotel tomorrow morning," he said.
Then he walked off without turning back. Farid followed him, carrying the heavy bag, happy as a stray dog who has found a master at last. That night the full moon hung round and orange in the sky. Before they went to bed, Mo pulled back the curtains so they could see it. A brightly coloured Chinese lantern among all the white stars. Neither of them could sleep. Mo had bought a couple of well-worn paperbacks that looked as if they had already passed through the hands of several people. Meggie was reading the book full of unpleasant characters that Eleanor had given her. She liked it, but at last her eyes closed with weariness, and she fell asleep. Beside her, Mo read on and on, while the orange moon shone in the foreign sky outside. When a confused dream woke her with a start sometime in the night, Mo was still sitting up in bed, the open book in his hand. The moon had disappeared long ago, and there was nothing but darkness to be seen through the window.
"Can't you sleep?" asked Maggie, sitting up.
"It was my left arm, that stupid dog bit, and you know I sleep best on my left side. Anyway, there's too much going around in my head."
"There's a lot going around in my head, too." Maggie turned to the bedside table and picked up the book of poems that Eleanor had given her. She stroked the binding, passed her hand over the curved spine, and traced the letters on the jacket with her forefinger.
"You know something, Mo?"
she said hesitantly.
"I think I'd like to be able to do it, too."
"Do what?"
Maggie stroked the binding of the book again. She thought she could hear the pages whispering very quietly.
"Read like that," she said. "Read aloud the way you do, and make everything come to life."
Mo looked at her. "You're out of your mind," he said. "That's what has caused all the trouble we're in."
"I know."
Mo closed his book, leaving his finger between the pages.
"Read me something aloud, Mo," said Maggie quietly. "Please. Just for once."
She offered him the book of poems.
"Eleanor gave me this as a present. She said nothing much could happen if you did."
"Oh, did she?" Mo opened the book. "Suppose it does, though."
He leafed through the smooth white pages. Maggie put her pillow close to his.
"Do you really have any idea how you might be able to read Dustfinger back into his story? Or were you making it up?"
"Nonsense. I'm useless at telling lies, as you know."
"Yes, I do."
Maggie couldn't help smiling.
"Well, what's your idea?"
"I'll tell you when I know if it works."
Mo was still leafing through Eleanor's book. Frowning, he read a page, turned it over, and read another.
"Please, Mo."
Maggie moved closer to him.
"Just one poem. A tiny little poem. Please, for me."
He sighed.
"Just one?"
Maggie nodded. Outside, the noise of the cars had died down. The world was as quiet as if it had spun itself into a cocoon, like a moth preparing itself to slip out in the morning, young again and good as new.
"Please, Mo, read to me," said Maggie.
So Mo began filling the silence with words. He lured them out of the pages, as if they had only been waiting for his voice. Words long and short, words sharp and soft, cooing, purring words. They danced through the room, painting stained-glass pictures, tickling the skin. Even when Maggie nodded off, she could still hear them, although Mo had closed the book long ago. Words that explained the world to her, its dark side and its light side. Words that built a wall to keep out bad dreams. And not a single bad dream came over the wall for the rest of that night. The next morning, a bird flew down and perched on Maggie's bed. A bird as orange as the light of last night's moon. She tried to catch it, but it flew away to the window where the blue sky was waiting for it. It collided with the invisible glass again and again, bumping its tiny head, until Mo opened the window and let it out.
"Well, do you still wish you could do it?"
asked Mo when Maggie had watched the bird fly away until it merged with the blue of the sky.
"It was beautiful," she said.
"Yes, but will it like this world?" asked Mo. "And what's gone to replace it in the world it came from?"
Maggie stayed by the window as Mo went downstairs to pay their bill. She remembered the last poem that Mo had read before she fell asleep. She picked up the book from her bedside table, hesitated for a moment, and opened it.
"There is a place where the sidewalk ends, and before the street begins, and there the grass grows soft and white, and there the sun burns crimson bright, and there the moonbird rests from his flight, to cool in the peppermint wind."
Maggie whispered the words aloud as she read them, but no moonbird flew down from the lamp,
and she must have been just imagining the smell of peppermint.
Chapter 24. Fenolio. Dustfinger and Farid were waiting for them in the parking lot when they left the hotel. Over the nearby hills, a warm wind was slowly driving rain clouds toward the sea. Everything seemed grey today, even the houses with their bright colour-washed walls and the flowering shrubs in the streets. Mo took the coastal road, which Eleanor had said was built by the Romans, and followed it farther west. All through the drive, the sea lay to their left, its water stretching to the horizon, sometimes hidden by houses, sometimes by trees. But this morning it didn't look half as inviting as it had on the day Meggie had come down from the mountains with Eleanor and Dustfinger. The grey of the sky cast a dull reflection on the blue waves, and the sea spray foamed like dirty dishwater. Several times Meggie found her gaze wandering to the hills on her right. Capricorn's village was hidden somewhere among them. Once she even thought she saw its pale church tower in a dark fold of the hills, and her heart beat faster, though she knew that it couldn't possibly be Capricorn's church. Her feet remembered all too well how long that endless journey down the mountainside had been. Mo was driving faster than usual, much faster. Obviously, he could hardly wait to reach their destination. After a good hour, they turned off the coast road and followed a narrow, winding lane through a valley grey with buildings. Greenhouses covered the hills here, their panes painted white for protection against the sun that was now hidden behind clouds. Only when the road went uphill did the country on both sides turn green again. The buildings gave way to natural meadowland, and stunted olive trees lined the road, which forked unexpectedly a couple of times. Mo had to keep consulting the map he had bought, but finally the right name appeared on a sign. They drove into a small village, little more than a square, a few dozen houses, and a church that looked very much like Capricorn's. When Meggie got out of the car, she saw the sea far below. The waves were so rough on this overcast day that even from this distance she could see the breakers. Mo had parked in the village square beside the memorial for the dead of two world wars. The list of names was long for such a small place. Meggie thought there were almost as many names as the village had houses.
"You can leave the car unlocked. I'll keep an eye on it," said Dustfinger, as Mo was about to lock up.
He threw his pack over his shoulder, put the sleepy grin on his chain, and sat on the steps in front of the war memorial. Farid sat down beside him without a word. Meggie looked uneasily at them both as she followed Mo.
"Remember, you promised not to mention me," Dustfinger called after them.
"Yes, all right," replied Mo.
Farid was playing with matches again. Meggie caught him at it when she looked around once more, but now he could extinguish the burning matches with his mouth quite well. But all the same, Dustfinger took the box of matches away from him, and Farid looked sadly at his empty hands. Meggie had met many people who loved books, sold them, collected them, printed them, or, like her father, prevented them from falling apart. But she had never before met anyone who wrote the words that filled a book's pages. She didn't even know the names of the authors of some of her favourite stories, let alone what they looked like. She had seen only the characters who emerged from the words to meet her, never the writer who had made them up. It was just as Mo had said. In general, one thought of writers as dead or very, very old. But the man who opened the door to them, after Mo had rung the bell twice, was neither. That is, he was certainly quite old, at least in Meggie's eyes, in his mid-60s or even older. His face was wrinkled like a turtle's, but his hair was black, without a trace of grey. She was to find out later that he dyed it. And he didn't look at all fragile. On the contrary, he planted himself so impressively in the doorway that Meggie was instantly tongue-tied. Luckily, Mo was not.
"Signor Fenolio?" he asked.
"Yes."
The face looked less forthcoming than ever. There was disapproval in every line of it, but Mo seemed undaunted.
I'm Mortimer Fulcart, he introduced himself, and this is my daughter Maggie. I'm here about one of your books.
A boy appeared at the door beside Fenolio, a little boy of about 5, and a small girl joined them on the other side of the doorway. She stared curiously, first at Mo, then at Maggie.
Pippo's picked the chocolate chips out of the cake,
Maggie heard her whisper as she looked anxiously up at Mo. When his eyes twinkled at her, she disappeared behind Fenolio's back, giggling. But Fenolio himself still looked anything but friendly.
All the chocolate chips, he growled. Very well, I'm coming. You go and tell Pippo he's in serious trouble.
The little girl nodded and ran away, obviously happy to be the bearer of bad news. The small boy clung to Fenolio's leg.
A very particular book, Mo went on. Inkheart. You wrote it quite a long time ago, and unfortunately I can't buy a copy anywhere now.
With the man's icy stare still resting on her father, Maggie could only marvel that the words didn't freeze on Mo's lips.
Oh, yes. So?
Fenolio crossed his arms. The girl appeared on his left again.
Pippo's hiding, she said.
That won't do him any good, said Fenolio. I can always find him.
The little girl scurried off again. Maggie heard her in the house, calling to the chocolate thief. Fenolio, however, turned back to Mo.
So what do you want? If you're planning to ask me clever questions of some kind about the book, forget it. I don't have time for that sort of thing. Anyway, as you said yourself, I wrote it ages ago.
No, there's only one question I was going to ask. I'd like to know if you still have any copies, and if so, may I buy one from you?
The old man's expression was no longer quite so forbidding as he inspected Mo.
How extraordinary! You must be really keen on that book, he murmured. I'm flattered, although, he added, and his face darkened again. I hope you're not one of those idiots who collect rare books just because they're rare, are you?
Mo couldn't help smiling.
No, he said. I want to read it, that's all. I just want to read it.
Fenolio braced an arm against the doorframe and looked at the house opposite as if he feared it might collapse at any moment. The street where he lived was so narrow that Mo could have touched both sides at once if he stretched out his arms. Many of the houses were built of coarse blocks of sandy grey stone, like the houses in Capricorn's village, but here there were flowers in window boxes and pots of plants on the steps, and many of the shutters looked as if they had been freshly painted. There was a baby carriage outside one house, a moped leaning against the wall of another, and voices floated into the street from open windows. Capricorn's village probably looked like this once, thought Maggie. An old woman passing by looked suspiciously at the strangers. Fenolio nodded to her, murmured a brief greeting, and waited until she had vanished behind a green-painted front door.
Inkheart, he said. That really is a long time ago, and it's odd that you should be asking about that one of all my books.
The girl came back. She tugged Fenolio's sleeve and whispered something in his ear. Fenolio's turtle face twisted in a smile. Maggie liked him better that way.
Oh, that's where he always hides, Paula, he told the little girl softly. Perhaps you should advise him to try a better hiding place.
Paula ran off for the third time, but not before gazing curiously at Maggie first.
"Well, you'd better come in," said Fenolio.
Without another word, he showed Mo and Maggie into the house, went down a dark, narrow hallway ahead of them, limping because the little boy was still clinging to his leg like a monkey, and pushed open the door to the kitchen, where the ruins of a cake stood on the table. Its brown icing was as full of holes as the binding of a book when bookworms have been gnawing at it for years.
"Pippo!"
Fenolio bellowed so loudly that even Maggie jumped, although she didn't feel guilty of any naughtiness.
"I know you can hear me, and I warn you, I shall tie a knot in your nose for every hole in this cake, understand?"
Maggie heard a giggle. It seemed to come from the cupboard next to the fridge. Fenolio broke a piece off the cake with the hole still in it.
"Paula," he said, "give this girl a slice if she doesn't mind the missing chocolate."
Paula emerged from under the table and looked inquiringly at Maggie. "I don't mind," said Maggie, whereupon Paula took a huge knife, cut an enormous piece of cake and put it on the table in front of her.
"Pippo, let's have one of the rose-pattern plates," said Finolio, and a hand stuck out of the cupboard, holding a plate in its chocolate-brown fingers.
Maggie was quick to take the plate before it dropped and put the piece of cake on it.
"What about you?" Finolio asked Mo.
"I'd prefer the book," said Mo. He was looking rather pale.
Finolio removed the little boy from his leg and sat down.
"Go and find another tree to climb, Rico," he said.
Then he looked thoughtfully at Mo.
"I'm afraid I can't help you," he said. "I don't have a single copy left. They were stolen, all of them. I lent them to an exhibition of old children's books in Genoa, a lavishly illustrated special edition, a copy with a signed dedication by the illustrator, and the two copies that belonged to my own children, with all their scribbled comments. I always asked them to mark the bits they liked best. And finally, my own personal copy. Every last one of them stolen 2 days after the exhibition opened."
Mo ran a hand over his face as if he could wipe the disappointment off it.
"Stolen," he said, "of course."
"Of course?"
Finolio narrowed his eyes and looked at Mo with great curiosity.
"You'll have to explain. In fact, I'm not letting you out of my house until I find out why you're interested in this of all my books. In fact, I might set the children on you, and you wouldn't like that."
Mo tried for a smile without much success.
"My copy was stolen as well," he said at last, "and that was a very special edition, too."
"Extraordinary!"
Finolio raised his eyebrows, which were like hairy caterpillars creeping above his eyes.
"Come on, let's hear your story."
All the hostility had vanished from his face. Curiosity, pure curiosity, had won out. In Finolio's eyes, Maggie saw the same insatiable hunger for a good new story that overcame her at the sight of any new and exciting book.
"There's not much to tell," said Mo.
Maggie heard in his voice that he didn't intend to tell the old man the truth.
"I restore books. That's how I make my living. I found yours in a second-hand bookstore some years ago, and I was going to give it a new binding, then sell it. But I liked it so much I kept it instead. And now it's been stolen, and I've been trying in vain to buy another copy. A friend who knows a great deal about rare books and how to get hold of them finally suggested I might try the author himself. She was the person who found me her address. So I came here."
Finolio wiped a few cake crumbs off the table.
"Fine," he said. "But that's not the whole story."
"What do you mean?"
The old man scrutinized Mo's face until he turned his head away and looked out of the narrow kitchen window.
"I mean, I can smell a good story miles away, so don't try keeping one from me. Out with it! And then you can have a piece of this magnificently perforated cake."
Paula clambered up onto Finolio's lap, nestled her head under his chin, and looked at Mo as expectantly as the old man himself had. But Mo shook his head.
"No, I think I'd better say no more. You wouldn't believe a word of it anyway."
"Oh, I'd believe all manner of things,"
Finolio assured Mo, cutting him a slice of cake.
"I'd believe any story at all, just so long as it's well told."
The cupboard door opened a crack, and Maggie saw a boy's head emerge.
"What about my punishment?" he asked.
Judging by his fingers, which were sticky with chocolate, this must be Pippo.
"Later," said Finolio. "I have something else to do now."
Disappointed, Pippo came out of the cupboard.
"You said you were going to tie knots in my nose."
"Double knots, seaman's knots, butterfly knots, any knots you fancy, but I have to hear this story first, so go and fool around with something else until I have time for you."
Pippo stuck his lower lip out sulkily and disappeared into the corridor. Rico, the little boy, ran after him. Mo remained silent, pushing cake crumbs off the rough tabletop, drawing invisible patterns on the wood with his forefinger.
"There's someone in this story, and I've promised not to tell you about him," he said at last.
"Keeping a bad promise makes it no better," said Finolio. "Or at least so a favourite book of mine says."
"I don't know if it was a bad promise,"
Mo sighed and looked up at the ceiling, as if the answer might be found there.
"Very well," he said. "I'll tell you. But Dustfinger will murder me if he finds out."
"Dustfinger? I once called a character that. Oh, yes, of course. The poor trickster in Inkheart. I killed him off in the last chapter but one. A very touching scene. I cried tears while I was writing it."
Maggie almost choked on the piece of cake she had just put in her mouth, but Vanolia went on calmly.
"I haven't killed off many of my characters, but sometimes it just happens. Death scenes aren't easy to write. They can too easily get sentimental, but I thought I did pretty well with Dustfinger's death."
Horrified, Maggie looked at Mo. "He dies? Did you know that?"
"Yes, of course. I've read the whole story, Maggie."
"But why didn't you tell him?"
"He didn't want to know."
Fenolia was following this exchange with a puzzled look on his face and with great curiosity.
"Who kills him?" asked Maggie. "Buster?"
"Ah, Buster!"
Fenolia smiled. Each of his separate wrinkles expressed self-satisfaction.
"One of the best villains I ever thought up. A rabid dog, but not half as bad as my other dark hero, Capricorn. Buster would have let his heart be torn out for Capricorn, but his master is a stranger to such loyalty. He feels nothing, nothing at all. He doesn't even enjoy his own cruelty. Yes, I really did think up some pretty dark characters for Inkheart. And then there's Shadow, Capricorn's hound, as I always called him to myself. Though, of course, that's far too friendly a name for such a monster."
"The Shadow?"
Maggie's voice was hardly more than a whisper.
"Does he kill Dustfinger?"
"No, no, I'm sorry. I'd quite forgotten your question. Once I begin talking about my characters, it's hard to stop me. No, one of Capricorn's men kills Dustfinger. It was a very successful scene. Dustfinger had some kind of tame marten. Capricorn's men wants to kill it because he enjoys killing small animals, so Dustfinger tries to save his furry friend and dies in the attempt."
Maggie said nothing.
"Poor Dustfinger," she thought. "Poor, poor Dustfinger."
She couldn't think of anything else.
"Which of Capricorn's men does it?" she asked. "Flatnose? Or Cockerel?"
Fenolia looked at her in surprise.
"Well, fancy that. You know all their names. I usually forget them soon after I've made them up."
"It's neither of them, Maggie," said Mo. "The murderer's name isn't even mentioned in the book. A whole pack of Capricorn's men is hunting Gwyn, and one of them draws a knife and uses it, a man who's probably still waiting for Dustfinger."
"Waiting for him?"
Fenolia looked at Mo, confused.
"That's terrible," whispered Maggie. "I'm glad I didn't read any more."
"What do you mean? Are you talking about my book?"
Fenolia's voice sounded hurt.
"Yes," said Maggie, "I am."
She looked at Mo, a question in her eyes.
"And Capricorn, who kills him?"
"No one."
"No one?"
Maggie stared at Fenolia so accusingly that he rubbed his nose awkwardly. It was an impressive nose.
"Why are you looking at me like that?" he cried. "Yes, I let him get away with it. He's one of my best villains. How could I kill him off? It's the same in real life. Notorious murderers get off scot-free and live happily all their lives, while good people die, sometimes the very best people. That's the way of the world. Why should it be different in books?"
"What about Buster? Does he stay alive too?"
Maggie remembered what Farid had said back in the ruined hovel.
"Why not kill them? That's what they were going to do to us."
"Buster stays alive too," replied Fenolia. "I remember toying for some time with the idea of writing a sequel to Inkheart, and I didn't want to do without those two. I was proud of them. And the Shadow was quite a success too. Yes, he really was. But I'm always most attached to my human characters. You know, if you were to ask me which of those two I was prouder of, Buster or Capricorn, I couldn't tell you. Even though some critics said they were just too nasty."
Mo stared out of the window again. Then he looked at Fenolia. "Would you like to meet them?" he asked.
"Me too!"
Fenolia looked at him in surprise. "Capricorn and Buster."
"Good God, no!"
Fenolia laughed so loud that Paula, quite frightened, put her hand over his mouth.
"Well, we did," said Mo wearily. "Meggy and I. And Dustfinger."
Chapter 25 The Wrong Ending. Fenolio said nothing for a long time after Mo had finished his story. Paula had gone off long ago in search of Pippo and Rico. Meggy heard them running over the wooden floorboards above them, back and forth, jumping, sliding, giggling and squealing. But in Fenolio's kitchen it was so quiet you could hear the tick of the clock on the wall by the window.
"Does he have those scars on his face? I expect you know what I mean. The fairies treated the cuts. That's why there are only slight scars left. Little more than 3 pale lines on the skin, is that right?"
Fenolio looked inquiringly at Mo, who nodded. Fenolio looked out of the window again, brushing a few crumbs off his pants.
"Buster scarred him," he said. "They both fancied the same girl."
Mo nodded. "Yes, I know." A window was open in the house opposite, and you could hear a woman scolding a child inside.
"I suppose I ought to feel very, very proud," murmured Fenolio. "Every writer wants to create lifelike characters, and mine are so lifelike, they've walked straight off the page."
"That's because my father read them out of the book," said Meggy. "He can do it with other books, too."
"Yes, of course," Fenolio nodded. "A good thing you reminded me. Otherwise I might start taking myself for a minor god, mightn't I? But I'm sorry about your mother. Although, depending on how you look at it, that wasn't really my fault."
"It's worse for my father," said Meggy. "I don't remember her."
Mo looked at her, startled.
"Of course not. You were younger than my grandchildren," said Fenolio thoughtfully. "I'd really like to see him," he added. "Dustfinger, I mean. Naturally, I'm sorry now that I thought up such an unhappy ending for the poor fellow, but it somehow seemed right for him. As Shakespeare puts it so well, everybody plays his part, and mine is a sad one."
He looked out into the street. Something fell and broke on the floor above them, but Fenolio didn't seem particularly interested.
"Are those your children?" asked Meggy, pointing up at the ceiling.
"Heaven help us, no! My grandchildren! One of my daughters lives in this village, too. They're always visiting me, and I tell them stories. I tell half the village stories, but I don't feel like writing them down anymore."
He turned to Mo with an inquiring look.
"Where is he now?"
"Dustfinger. I can't tell you. He doesn't want to see you."
"He got quite a shock when my father told him about you," added Meggy. "But Dustfinger must be told what happens to him," she thought. "He must. Then he'll understand why he really can't go back. And all the same," she thought next, "he'll still be homesick. Homesick forever."
"I must see him only once, don't you understand?"
Fenolio looked pleadingly at Mo.
"I could just follow you inconspicuously. How would he know who I am? I want to find out if he really looks the way I imagined him, that's all."
However, Mo shook his head. "I think you'd better leave him alone."
"Nonsense! Surely I can see him whenever I like. After all, I invented him."
"And you killed him off,"
Meggy pointed out.
"Well?"
Fenolia raised his hands helplessly.
"I wanted to make the story more exciting. Don't you like exciting stories?"
"Only if they have happy endings."
"Happy endings?"
Fenolio snorted scornfully and then listened to what was going on upstairs. Something or someone had landed heavily on the wooden floorboards. Loud howls followed the thud. Fenolio strode to the door.
"Wait here, I'll be back in a minute,"
he called, disappearing into the corridor.
"Mo," whispered Meggy, "you've got to tell Dustfinger. You've got to tell him he can't go back."
But Mo shook his head.
"He won't want to listen, I promise you. I've tried more than a dozen times. Perhaps it wouldn't be a bad idea to bring him together with Fenolio after all. He might well be more likely to believe his creator than me."
With a sigh, he brushed a few cake crumbs off Fenolio's kitchen table. There was a picture in Inkheart, he murmured, raising the palm of his hand over the tabletop, as if to conjure up the picture itself. It showed a group of women standing under an arched gateway in splendid clothes as if they were going to a party. One of them had hair as fair as your mother's. You can't see the woman's face in the picture. She has her back turned. But I always imagined it was her. Crazy, isn't it?
Maggie placed her hand on his. Mo, promise me you won't go back to the village, she said. Please. Promise me you won't try to get the book back.
The second hand on Fenolia's kitchen clock was dividing time into painfully small segments. At last, Mo answered. I promise, he said.
Look at me and say it.
He did. I promise, he repeated. There's just one more thing I want to discuss with Fenolio, and then we'll go home and forget about the book.
Happy now?
Maggie nodded, although she wondered what else there could be to discuss. Fenolio returned with a tearful Pippo on his back. The other two children followed their grandfather, looking crestfallen.
Holes in the cake and now a dent in his forehead, too. I think I ought to send all of you home,
Fenolio told them crossly as he put Pippo down on a chair. Then he rummaged around in the big cupboard until he found a band-aid, which he stuck none too gently on his grandson's cut forehead. Mo pushed his chair back and stood up.
I've changed my mind, he said. I'll take you to Dustfinger after all.
Fenolio turned to him in surprise.
Perhaps you can make it clear to him once and for all that he can't go back, Mo continued. Goodness knows what he might do next. I'm afraid it could be dangerous for him. And I do have this idea, rather a weird idea. But I'd like to talk to you about it. Weirder than what I've heard already? I'd say that's hardly possible.
Fenolia's grandchildren had disappeared into the cupboard again. Giggling, they closed the doors.
Very well, I'll listen to your idea, said Fenolio. But I want to see Dustfinger first.
Mo looked at Maggie. It wasn't often that he broke a promise, and he clearly felt far from comfortable about it. Maggie could understand that only too well.
He's waiting in the square, said Mo hesitantly. But let me talk to him first. In the square here?
Fenolio's eyes widened.
That's wonderful!
With one stride he was standing in front of the little mirror hanging next to the kitchen door, running his fingers through his black hair, almost as if he were afraid Dustfinger might be disappointed by his creator's appearance.
I'll pretend I don't see him until you call me, he said. Yes, that's the thing to do.
There was a clattering in the cupboard, and Pippo stumbled out in a jacket that came down to his ankles and a hat so large that it had slipped right over his eyes.
Of course!
Fenolio took the hat off Pippo's head and put it on his own.
That's it! I'll take the children with me. A grandfather with three grandchildren, nothing about that sight to make anyone uneasy, is there?
Mo just nodded and pushed Maggie out into the narrow hallway. As they walked down the street, leading back to the square and their car, Fenolio followed a few meters behind them, with his grandchildren running and jumping around him like three puppies. Chapter 26 Shivers Down the Spine and a Foreboding. Dustfinger sat on the chilly stone steps waiting. He felt sick with fear, but he wasn't quite sure of what. Perhaps the war memorial behind him reminded him too much of death. He had always been afraid of death, which he imagined as cold, too, like a night without fire. Now, however, he dreaded something else even more. Its name was sorrow, and it had been stalking him like a second shadow ever since Silvertongue lured him into this world. Sorrow that made his limbs heavy and turned the sky grey. Beside him, the boy was running up and down the steps. Up and down, tirelessly, with light feet and a cheerful face, as if Silvertongue had led him straight into paradise. What could be making him so happy? Dustfinger looked around at the narrow houses. Pale yellow, pink,
peach, the dark green shutters at the windows, and the rust-red tiles on the roofs, an oleander flowering in front of a wall as if its branches were on fire, cats stalking past the warm walls. Farid stole up to one of them, stroked its grey fur, and put it on his lap, although it dug its claws into his thighs.
"You know what people do to keep the numbers of cats down around here?"
Dustfinger stretched his legs and blinked up at the sun.
"When winter comes, they take their own cats indoors for safety. Then they put out dishes of poisoned food for the strays."
Farid still fondled the grey cat's pointed ears, but his face was rigid and grim, not a trace left of the happiness that had just made it look so soft and open. Dustfinger glanced quickly aside. Why had he said that? Had the happiness on the boy's face upset him so much? Farid let the cat go and climbed the steps to the memorial. He was still sitting there on the wall, legs drawn up, when the other two came back. Silvertongue had no book with him, and he looked strained. His guilty conscience was clearly visible on his face. Why? What could have made Silvertongue look so guilty? Dustfinger glanced suspiciously around without knowing quite what he was looking for. Silvertongue's face always showed his feelings. He was an open book which any stranger could read. His daughter was different. It wasn't so easy to make out what was going on in her mind. But now, as she came toward him, Dustfinger thought he saw something like concern in her eyes, perhaps even pity. What had that writer fella said to make the girl look at him like that? He got up and brushed the dust off his pants.
"No copies left, am I right?" he asked when the two of them had reached him.
"You're right. They've all been stolen," replied Silvertongue, "years ago."
His daughter never took her eyes off Dustfinger.
"Why are you staring at me like that, princess?" he snapped. "Do you know something I don't?"
Bullseye. An accidental one, too. He hadn't wanted to score a bullseye at all, certainly not a direct hit on an uncomfortable truth. The girl bit her lip, still looking at him with that same mixture of pity and concern. Dustfinger rubbed his hand over his face, feeling his scars on it like a picture postcard saying, "Greetings from Basta." He could never forget Capricorn's rabid dog for a single day, even if he wanted to.
"To help you please the girls even better in the future," Basta had hissed in his ear before wiping the blood off his knife. "Oh, curse it all!"
Dustfinger kicked the nearest wall so hard that he felt the pain in his foot for days to come.
"You've told that writer about me," he accused Mo, "and now even your daughter knows more about me than I do. Very well, out with it. I want to know now, too. Tell me. You always wanted to tell me, after all. Basta hangs me, is that it? Strings me up and tightens the noose until I'm dead as a doornail, right? But why should that bother me? Basta's in this world now, isn't he? The story's changed. It must have changed. Basta can't hurt me if you just send me back there where I belong."
Dustfinger took a step towards Silvertongue as if to grab him, shake him, take out on him all that had been done to himself, but Maggie came between them.
"Stop it! It's not Basta," she cried, pushing him away. "It's one of Capricorn's men, and he's waiting for you in the book. They want to kill Gwyn, and you try to help him, so they kill you instead. Nothing about that has changed. It will simply happen, and there's nothing you can do about it. Do you understand? You must stay here. You can't go back, ever."
Dustfinger stared at the girl as if he could shut her up that way, but she held his gaze. She even tried to take his hand.
"You should be glad to be here," she faltered as he retreated from her. "You can escape from them here. You can go away, far away, and..."
Her voice quivered. Perhaps she had seen the tears in Dustfinger's eyes. Angrily, he wiped them away with his sleeve and looked around like an animal in a trap, searching for some way out. But there was no way out. No going forward, and even worse, no going back. A trio of women standing at the bus stop glanced curiously in his direction.
Dustfinger often attracted such glances. Anyone could see he didn't belong here. A stranger forever. Three children and an old man were playing football with a tin can on the other side of the square. Farid looked at them. The Arab boy had Dustfinger's backpack over his narrow shoulders, and grey cat hairs clung to his pants. He was deep in thought, wriggling his bare toes into the gaps between the paving stones. He was always taking off the sneakers Dustfinger had bought him, and going around barefoot, even on hot tarmac, with his shoes tied to the backpack like loot he was taking home. Silvertongue looked at the playing children, too. Had he given some sign to the old man with them? The old fellow left the children and came over. Dustfinger took a step back. A shiver ran down his spine.
"My grandchildren have been admiring the tame marten that boy has on a chain," said the old man as he approached.
Dustfinger took another step backward. Why was this dark-haired man looking at him like that? In quite a different way than the women at the bus stop.
"The children say the marten can do tricks and the boy's a fire-eater. Perhaps we could come to the show and watch at close range."
The cold shiver spread right through Dustfinger, although the sun was shining down on him. The way the old man looked at him, as if he were a dog who had run away long ago and was now back, tail between his legs, perhaps with lice in his coat, but definitely his, the old man's dog.
"Nonsense. We don't do tricks," he managed to say. "There's nothing to see here."
He retreated again, but the old man followed him, as if they were linked by an invisible thread.
"I'm sorry," said the old man, raising a hand as if to touch Dustfinger's scarred face.
Dustfinger's back came up against a parked car. Now the old man was standing right in front of him, and still staring, staring.
"Go away!"
Dustfinger pushed him roughly back.
"Farid, bring me my things!"
The boy hurried to his side. Dustfinger snatched the backpack from his hand, picked up the marten, and stowed him in the pack, taking no notice of the animal's sharp, snapping teeth. The old man stared at Gwyn's horns. Fingers flying, Dustfinger slung the pack over his shoulder and tried to push past him.
"Please, I only want to talk to you."
The old man barred his way, reaching for his arm.
"Well, I don't want to talk to you."
Dustfinger tried to free himself from the bony fingers. They were surprisingly strong, but Dustfinger had the knife. Buster's clasp knife. He took it out of his pocket, snapped it open, and held it under the old man's chin. His hand was trembling. He had never enjoyed threatening anyone with a knife, but the old man let go. And Dustfinger ran. He ignored whatever Silvertongue was calling after him. He just ran for it, as he had often done in the past. He could trust his legs, even if he didn't yet know where they were taking him. He left the village and the road behind, dodged under some trees, ran through wild grass, plunged in among the mustard-yellow bramble bushes, let the silvery foliage of the olive trees hide him. He had to get away from the houses, away from the paved roads. Wild country had always protected him. Only when every breath he drew hurt him did he throw himself down into the long grass, behind an abandoned cistern where frogs croaked, and the rainwater that had collected among the grey stones steamed in the sun. He lay there, gasping, listening to his own heartbeat and staring at the sky. He jumped.
"Who's that?"
The boy stood there. Farid had followed him.
"Go away!" shouted Dustfinger.
The boy crouched down among the wildflowers that grew everywhere, blue and yellow, and red splashes of bright colour in the grass.
"I don't want you," snapped Dustfinger.
The boy said nothing, but picked a wild orchid and examined the bloom. It looked like a bumblebee on the tip of a flower stem. "What a strange flower," he murmured. "I've never seen one like that before." Dustfinger sat up and leaned against the side of the cistern.
"You'll be sorry if you keep running after me," he said. "I'm going back. You know where to."
Only when he said it did he realize that he had made up his mind long ago. Yes, he was going back. Dustfinger, the coward, was going back into the lion's den. Never mind what Silvertongue said, nor what his daughter thought. There was only one thing he wanted. He had never wanted anything else. And if he couldn't have it now, then at least he could hope that one day his wish would come true. The boy stayed sitting there.
Go away, will you? Go back to Silvertongue. He'll look after you.
Farid sat there unmoved, his arms around his knees. You're going back to that village?
Yes, the village where the devils and demons live. Believe me, they'll kill a boy like you and eat you for breakfast. They'll enjoy their coffee all the more afterward.
Farid stroked his cheeks with the orchid. He made a face as the petals tickled his skin. Gwyn wants to get out, he said. He was right. The marten was biting the fabric of the backpack and sticking his muzzle out of it. Dustfinger undid the straps and freed him. Gwyn blinked up at the sun, chattered crossly, presumably complaining that it was the wrong time of day, and scurried over to the boy. Farid picked him up, put him on his shoulder, and looked earnestly at Dustfinger. I've never seen flowers like this, he repeated. Or such green hills. Or such a clever marten. But I know a lot about the kind of men you mean. They're the same everywhere. Dustfinger shook his head.
These are particularly bad.
No, not particularly. The defiance in Farid's voice made Dustfinger laugh. He himself didn't know why. We could go somewhere else, said the boy.
No, we couldn't.
Why not? What are you planning to do in that village?
Steal something, said Dustfinger.
The boy nodded as if stealing were the most natural plan in the world, and carefully put the orchid in his pants pocket. Will you teach me a little more about fire first, before we go there?
Before?
Dustfinger couldn't help smiling. The boy was a clever lad, and no doubt he knew there wouldn't be any after.
Of course, he said. I'll teach you everything I know, before we go there.
Chapter 27 A Good Place to Stay. They did not set off to join Eleanor after Dustfinger had left them. Meggie, I know I said we would, said Mo, as they stood in the square, in front of the war memorial, feeling rather at a loss. But I'd like to leave the journey until tomorrow. As I told you before, there's something else I have to discuss with Fenolio. The old man was still standing where he had been when he spoke to Dustfinger, staring down the road. His grandchildren were pulling at him and talking to him, but he didn't seem to notice them. What exactly do you want to discuss with him? Mo sat on the steps in front of the memorial and made Meggie sit down beside him. Do you see those names? He asked, pointing up at the chiseled letters, listing people no longer alive. There's a family behind every name, a mother or father, brothers and sisters, perhaps a wife. If one of them were to find out that letters can be brought to life, that someone who's only a name now could become flesh and blood again, don't you think he or she would do anything, anything at all, to make it happen? Meggie looked at the long list. Someone had painted a heart next to the name at the top, and there was a bunch of dried flowers on the stone steps in front of the memorial. No one can bring back the dead, Meggie, Mo went on. Perhaps it's true that death is only the beginning of a new story, but no one has ever read the book in which it's written, and the writer of that book certainly doesn't live in a little village on the coast playing football with his grandchildren. Your mother's name isn't on a stone like this, but hidden somewhere in a book. And I have an idea that just might make it possible to alter what happened 9 years ago.
You're going back?
No, I'm not. I gave you my word. Have I ever broken it? Meggie shook her head.
You broke your word to Dustfinger, she thought, but she didn't say so out loud.
There you are, then, said Mo. I want to talk to Fenolio. That's the only reason why I want to stay. Meggie looked at the sea, The sun had broken through the clouds, and all of a sudden the water was glistening and shining, as if someone had poured paint into it.
"It's not far from here," she murmured.
"What isn't?"
"Capricorn's village."
Mo looked eastward. "Yes,"